Good evening, Kia ora, nice to see you here this evening. It's been a long day, but for those who participated in the Armistice Day service this morning, I'm pleased we actually did go indoors. It's been a shocker of a day. For those who I haven't met and don't know me, I'm Joe Hollander, Chair of the Palmerston North Defence Heritage Advisory Group and the Engineer Charitable Trust. And it's our privilege, along with the Palmerston North City Library, to host these sessions. Now, springing surprises on people, but the person who should have been presenting tonight is one Christopher Pugsley, who I'm sure many of you will know anyway, who's come up especially to listen to our, I was going to say our fill-in, but no. No, definitely not. To Ian, who has also spoken to us before. In fact, as you know, we've got quite an entourage of military historians who grace us with many very, very interesting topics. So the program tonight is firstly Peter Hurley, who is our Palmerston North RSA president, has an interesting piece of archival heritage material there, and I'll let Peter explain that first. Then we'll introduce Ian, who will give the main topic of presentation tonight. So, without further ado, Peter, can I hand over to you, please?
Thanks, Joe. I just thought, seeing it's Armistice Day, this would be an interesting topic to display. I didn't want to steal Ian's thunder at all, but I got this about 8 years ago or so. It's just a framed signaller's form, and with a little newspaper clipping. And the signaller was, according to the newspaper clipping, was Craburn Stanley Barrick. But according to, which I managed to find, his enlistment papers with the AIF, his name is Graeburn Stanley Barrick. Anyway, the point being, though, that he was apparently the signaller on duty at Ypres in 1918, the 11th of November, when the message came through about the cessation of hostilities. So he wrote it down on the message pad and then decided to keep it. And it's kind of well-worn, together with a bit of sellotape on there. And because it's so worn, at the back of it I've actually got the transcript of what it says. So just for interest's sake, the hostilities will cease on the 11th day, on the 11th month, and so there you are. That's it.
Thanks, Pete. Yeah. Take a look at it before you go tonight, but don't take it away with you. Otherwise, Peter won't be very happy. Our speaker tonight, as I said, is Dr. Ian McGibbon. Ian should be pretty well known to you all, a very well-renowned military historian. Was the general editor of war history at the Ministry of Culture and Heritage, and has done a lot of research over all of our military history for New Zealand, and in particular on the Gallipoli Peninsula. So I'm not going to say anything more about what Ian's going to talk to us about tonight, other than to say, please put your hands together and welcome.
Thanks, Joe. Thank you all for venturing out tonight to listen. So I'm going to speak tonight about two myths that I believe exist in New Zealand's military history in 1914-15. The first one is Bernard Freyberg's supposed service in the Mexican Civil War in 1914 and William Malone's refusal to carry out an order to attack at Chanuk Bear on the 7th of August 1915. New Zealand military history is full of myths. They go back to Maori fortifications forming the basis of trench warfare in the First World War, the number of people who served at Gallipoli. Myths are like weeds. You pull them out and everything's fine for a while, but they reappear, mainly because journalists tend to go for good stories or don't do any research. And sometimes they're the result of hoaxes, as you'll find, I think, hopefully tonight. It's very difficult to change the narrative once it's been established in the historical memory of the country. Bernard Freiberg's most recent biographer devoted a whole chapter to Freiberg's Mexican adventure, a chapter title. And the Prime Minister, John Key, at Chinook Bear on Anzac Day 2015, described Malone's refusal of an order as part of his speech. And 2 years later, Amy Adams, at the same venue, gave the same comment. Let's start by looking at Freiberg's timeline in California. On the 27th of March 1914, he left Wellington on the SS Tahiti. It called in at Tahiti, and it finally arrived in San Francisco on the 20th of April, so it's a trip of about 3 weeks. He was in California until the 7th of August 1914, when he departed from San Francisco for New York. It took him a week to get across America, and he left New York on the SS Cedric on the 14th. Another 10 days across the Atlantic, he arrived in Liverpool on the 24th, and the next day he took a train to London. So he was in California for 15 weeks. Now there's two bases to the Freiberg Mexico myth. The first one arose from a letter he wrote on the 28th of April 1914. He said, "Last week I gave my name in to go to Mexico, only to be told they did not require anybody other than those they had. And if they had required any volunteers, I would be written to." So Paul Freiberg, Freiberg's biographer's son, deduced that Freiberg tried to go to Mexico and that he was going to go and serve President of Mexico, Huerta. The story took on a few embellishments. A later embellishment, some time ago, he went out to Mexico and offered his services to Huerta. Huerta did not want him, so he went and fought with Pancho Villa on the opposite side. Well, the problem with that was that when Freiberg arrived in California, there was a great state of excitement. It appeared that Mexico and the United States were about to go to war, and irregular units were leaving San Francisco, the forts at San Francisco, to go to the border, the southern border, the border with Mexico, and volunteer units were being formed. And that's the unit that Freiberg tried to join, I believe. And they told him that he couldn't join because they already had enough men. He then commented that he signed up as an armed guard after looking after the National Film Unit, which is going to the Mexican War to take pictures of the war. And I believe he left San Francisco early in May. I looked at a movie magazine which indicated that a film unit did leave early May, and I think that's the one that Freiberg was on with. So they went down there and spent about a week or 10 days in Southern California. The American troops never crossed the border, so they were always still in the United States. And the war fever evaporated. And the film unit was back in San Francisco. I know he was back in San Francisco by the 25th of May because he was interviewed by a journalist for the San Francisco Call newspaper. The second myth is more important. In On the 13th of October 1914, the Evening Post published a story about Freiberg and his personal column. He went recently to America for a holiday, and there, in a spirit of adventure, he took service as a transport officer under General Vila, one of the opponents of the Mexican usurper Huerta. He had only been in this position for 2 or 3 weeks and was in the province of Durango when the war broke out. It would have been useless to ask to resign, so Mr. Freiberg left the Vila camp in the night and made for Mazatlan on Mexico's Pacific coast, walking by day and hiding by night. Thence he went to San Diego and Los Angeles, Cheyenne and Chicago, and from New York to Liverpool. Quite a specific route, which I think is important, and I'll come back to that. Now, once Freiberg became famous, many people started to remember someone who they thought must have been Freiberg in Mexico, and the story was embellished. So you had him serving as a general, even though he couldn't speak Spanish, escaping from Villa's army on the war's outbreak and trekking 800 kilometres to the port of Tampico on the Gulf of Mexico, on the other side of Mexico, to embark by sea from New York and thence to the United Kingdom. Now, I did read another account of a film unit that went to visit Villa. Pancho Villa. It took them 3 weeks to go from Los Angeles to where Villa was. So Mexico in 1914 is not like Mexico in 2022. You couldn't, the roading system was rudimentary. You couldn't move quickly through that country. Now, I mentioned that he was interviewed by the journalist who put an article in the paper on the 26th of May 1914, and it was headlined, "Blue Gold Gets Australian Rugger." I know it's not very distinct, but it actually is referring to Bernard Freiberg. And basically his fame was that he was a rugby player. In California at the time, rugby was big. The universities, Stanford and Berkeley, were competing to be the rugby champions of California. Unfortunately, the All Blacks visited California in 1913, beat every team by 50 or 60 points, and Americans hate losers. Their attitude to rugby faded away, and they turned to gridiron, and that became the university sport. So let's look at Freiberg's activities between 26 May and 7 August 1914. On the 4th of June, he did write a letter. He was in Bakersfield, which is in the central valley of California. He did say, "I'm going down to Mexico to look for a job of any description, as I think I would like to see a bit more bit of that part of this continent." Freiberg was a dentist, but he didn't have a degree. An apprentice, basically, did a short course at Otago University. I don't think he could work in California without a degree, and I suspect that he thought he would go down to Mexico where there was no regulation at all and perhaps be able to make some money as a dentist. I should have added, he was intending, in that newspaper article, it said he was intending to go to Berkeley, University of California at Berkeley, to do a dentistry degree, and he had 4 months to fill in before the courses started. So he went up to Sacramento to look for work, and then he went down to Bakersfield. I think he was thinking of going to Mexico, but I don't think he actually went across the border. When he was appointed commander of Cree Force before the Battle of Crete, the Hanford Sentinel, Hanford is a town in the Central Valley, had a headline, "Defender of Crete once coaling a man." And it stated that he had been an oil field official And I believe that Freyberg was appointed as an official. There was a problem with water and the oil in California, and that the state regulated how much water was in them. And someone went round and took the details. And I suspect that that was probably the job that Freyberg was given, to go around the various oil fields. Oil was big, and Bakersfield is the centre of California's oil industry. I believe that Freyberg would have spent up to 6 weeks in Coalinga, which is about 250 kilometres southwest of San Francisco. Now, I know that he was in Bakersfield on the 28th of June, arranging a water polo team, as the local paper reported it. And in the following week, Independence Day, he took part in, he refereed, he helped organise an aquatic carnival, it was called, and he swam, I can't go into the details, but it's quite a detailed report in the Morning Echo. He swam against some kid with some penalty against him. I can't remember the exact details, but it all made the local paper. So this puts Freyberg in California, late June, early July. He obviously went back to San Francisco about mid-July, because Harry Maloney was the rugby coach at Stanford University. He was very interested in recruiting Freyberg. They were competing with Berkeley. And when Freyberg became famous during the Second World War, Maloney said, so Freyberg came down to the farm, which was a fraternity house at Stanford University, and spent a couple of weeks, I highlighted that, because that implies that he was there for the last half of July, because he was still there when the 1st of August came around. I should say that Harry Maloney was adamant that Freyberg had never been to Mexico and had never been in the Mexican Civil War. Now, there's an All Black connection here, because I mentioned the All Blacks went to San Francisco, and one of the members of the team, Jim Wiley, didn't come home. He stayed in California and spent the rest of his life on the west coast of the United States. And when Freyberg won his Victoria Cross, he was reported to have said that he was with Freyberg in the San Francisco Press Club on the 1st of August. That was the date that news arrived in San Francisco that war had broken out in Europe. He said that he and Freyberg walked down to the railway station to return to Stanford, and while they were walking, Freyberg bought five editions. Late editions were coming out all the time of the latest news, what was happening in Europe. The newspaper reported that the next day, on the 2nd of August, Freyberg played a wonderful game for the Barbarians against the Surf Beach in the Water Polo Championship game in San Francisco. Remember, this is when he was supposed to be making his way from Durango in Mexico to New York. Freyberg was a reserve officer, I'm not quite sure if that's the right word, but he was a former territorial officer, and he had a duty to report his whereabouts. He sent a cable from, we got the Consul General, the British Consul General in San Francisco, to send a message to Wellington to say that he was going to London to report for duty. In fact, all the Australians and New Zealanders had been instructed to report to their country's commissioner in San Francisco because of their liability to serve. Freyberg ignored that instruction because he feared that the New Zealand Expeditionary Force, which was being formed, would end up in the backwater. He wanted to be in the action, so he wanted to join a British regiment, not the New Zealand Force. The San Francisco call had a an article about Freiburg leaving, football hero to fight for England, and it described how Freiburg was leaving to go to London in the interests of John Bull, and it said he leaves for New York today. These are important because the story was that he was making his way by moving at night and sleeping during the day to a town in Mexico. Now, it's ironical that Freiburg apparently told some of his friends, his football friends, and you have to bear in mind that he never actually played a game of football in California. It was the off-season, so despite the fact that he was referred to as a rugger hero, football hero, he never actually played. He did swim. He played water polo. He said to one of his football friends, "I have never done any fighting. I rather expect I shall be an awful coward." A very ironical statement. But it also sort of bears out that for someone who had fought in the Mexican Civil War, he wouldn't say, "I've never done any fighting." So it sort of bears out my contention that Freiburg never went to Mexico. It's ironical because he won the Victoria Cross and three times was appointed companion to the Distinguished Service Order. The last one, of course, being because of his actions in the few minutes before the armistice, which we just heard about, capturing a bridge in Belgium, France. At the expense, unfortunately, of some German soldiers who were killed 2 minutes before 11 a.m. What is the origin of the Pancho Villa myth? So you had Freiburg arriving at Liverpool on the 24th of August. The next day he took the train to London. And the following day he went to the War Office because Major Richardson was serving there, and as a territorial officer, he thought he would make contact with him, who was New Zealand's military representative in London as well. But he secured an interview with the First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill. Richardson, I should say, was being preparing to be part of the creation of the Royal Naval Division, which the Navy formed of extra men that it had to serve as infantry, basically. He secured the interview through Churchill's secretary, but it didn't occur until later. On the 27th of August, he must have met Guy Schofield, who was the New Zealand Associated Press correspondent in London, because Schofield that day sent the report on Freiburg's escape from Peel's army, which was published in the Evening Post, like the one that I played earlier in the presentation. That report had the date 27 August in the newspaper, so... In the next few days, Freiburg met Churchill and was offered a commission, which he gained on the 8th of September, 1914. The commission was temporary lieutenant commander in the Royal Naval Division. Now that's the report that appeared in the Evening Post. Unfortunately, I've cut off the date at the top, 27 August. The Evening Post must have added at the bottom, in the last sentences, that Churchill has since arranged Mr. Freiburg to receive the Lieutenant's Commission, da-da-da, and he will go to Deal for training. And Freiburg himself denied that he had ever been in Mexico in 1948, when he was visiting Melbourne. He was the Governor General of New Zealand by then. He said, "But I would like to say that I have never been to Mexico. That story started in 1916. The story has been voiced with such authority for so long that I no longer bother to contradict it." Now, there's only one person who could have given Schofield that very detailed description of him escaping from Mexico, and it had to be Freiberg. He knew that the story started in 1914, so he's not being entirely truthful even in his statement to the Australians. It's interesting, in the Turnbull Library there's an exchange of letters between him and Schofield, who ended up being the editor of Who's Who in New Zealand. And Freiberg very carefully asked Schofield to take out all references to Mexico and various other... He had to sort of disguise it. He said, please don't include anything about my life before 1935 or something. So I took out the Mexico reference without alerting Schofield to the fact that Freiberg had spun a yarn to him in 1914. And Freiberg's motive is an interesting question. He wasn't averse to lying to advance himself in this period before he became famous. He claimed that he was selected for the All Blacks to tour California, but he had to withdraw because his father died. Whereas, in fact, his father died 2 months after the tour ended. And I suspect that Freiberg was hoping that that might help him secure a sports scholarship. And you saw the headlines in the papers how he was a football hero. That would have been useful to him. He also claimed he was a graduate of the University of Otago. He was seeking entry to the University of California. He did go to Otago University for a month, I think, for a brief, because apprentice dentists and government said we should make them do a little course just to ensure that they had got some university back training. And he did that, but he didn't have a degree in dentistry. And I think the claim to have served in Pancho Villa's army was really related to his desire to get a commission in the British forces. With a little bit of active service, it probably would increase his chances. At least that's why. What other reason would he spin such a strange story about escaping? And Schofield, it's not like the internet today where you can press a few buttons and check these things. But Schofield was a bit naive not to think it's very hard to move in Mexico 200 kilometres just moving by night and then have time to get all the way to New York. A little bit of questioning, but he had no reason to believe that Freiberg was lying to him. So that was basically the end of my... presentation on Freiberg's. I mean, we're all human, and Freiberg, before he became famous, was just like any of us, trying to advance himself and perhaps push the bounds of truth to some extent. It's not to decry his later service and his bravery. I'll leave it at that. But let's go on to the second part of my presentation, which is about Colonel Malone's refusal of an order. The Prime Minister, Chunuk Bear, said, "The Auckland Battalion tried to take Chunuk Bear, but was forced back with heavy casualties. Next in line was the Wellington Battalion, but its commanding officer, Colonel Malone, refused to send his men to their certain deaths in a daylight attack. They waited until night fell." And he praised his courage of being insubordinate in order to save his men's lives. Now this comment is based on a statement that was made and recorded in the Morris Show Notes, but Chris may have done the interview, I don't know, but he's got the actual recording. He's going to play it to you later. but it said, so the Wellington Battalion, all lined up and ready, was called to go next by the two British commanders. It seemed we were just a few seconds from following the Aucklanders into that fire. Stop where you are, Colonel Malone told us. I was standing just near Malone when the British gave the order. It was very stern and strong face. Malone told the British commanders, no, you're not taking orders from your people. Wellington is not going up there. My men are not going to commit suicide. There was a big row when he refused their orders. Malone said, these men, the Wellingtons, are under my orders, not yours. I take responsibility for them not going up there. I will take all risk and any punishment. We will take Chinook Bear tonight, in the dark, not in daylight. These two Englishmen threatened to arrest Malone for insubordination. I reckon if they tried arresting him, we would have shot them. Malone just ordered, Wellington Battalion, come back from that ridge. So we did. Now bear in mind, this is a recollection of a 93-year-old man who was remembering events 67 years earlier. Let's look at the timeline for the 6th, 7th August 1915. 10:30 p.m. on the 6th, New Zealand Infantry Brigade under Brigadier General Earl Johnson began its advance up Chilak Deer. It wasn't an easy passage, and the advance was delayed. Essentially, they were still emerging from Chilak Deer as dawn broke, roughly 4:15 in the morning. About an hour later, the Wellington Infantry Battalion under Lieutenant Colonel Malone emerged from Chilak Deer onto Rhododendron Ridge. At 9:30, Major General Godley, the commander of the division, ordered Johnson to attack. And an hour later, the Auckland Battalion under Robert Young and several Gurkha companies attacked. 15 minutes later, the Aucklanders were sheltering in a trench, the Pinnacle Trench. They got forward about 100 metres, I think it was about 100 metres, before they were forced to go to ground. Now this is just an illustration. The white mark on the right is the three battalions of the New Zealand Brigade. Otago on the front, Wellington, Auckland, and then the Canterbury came up the left-hand arrow, came up the next valley, then came up from the other direction, and they ended up at what's called the Akings. And the trench where the Aucklanders were held up was at the Pinnacle. So the question is, did Malone refuse to attack when the Auckland Battalion was halted at 10:45, roughly? The first reason I don't believe this happened was that for Malone to refuse an order, Johnson had to acquiesce. Now, the thing is that you can refuse an order if you're the man on the spot and the general way back isn't quite as up with what's happening at the front. And Major Templey, the brigade major, actually urged Johnson not to make the attack, because it was going to be suicidal. They both knew it was suicidal. Malone would ever have refused an order in the face of the enemy. That was a death penalty offence, a heinous military crime. Especially as both of them were there at the spot. The most likely thing would have happened would have been Johnson would have immediately relieved him of command and ordered Cunningham, the second in command, to take over, or brought someone else in. A more important reason is, on the advance, the Otago Battalion had been severely disrupted. It had to intervene on Bocops Hill. It had to go up onto Tabletop. It wasn't in top condition when it finally got onto the road to Denton Ridge. It took up a defensive position and then was ordered back down into Chilak Valley there. The Canterbury Battalion was in disarray. It had got lost on its advance and gone back and then came forward again and had suffered some casualties. The Auckland Battalion was now in, had been decimated in that attack. Johnson would then, if Clark was right, would then order his only intact battalion to make another attack, which was going to have the same fate. No, I don't think that was a possibility. He would have. They were in a salient in Turkish ground. They didn't know what was coming towards them over the top of the hill. He wasn't going to sacrifice another battalion on another futile attack towards Tunic Bear at that point. Now, the Canterbury Infantry Battalion was actually in support of the Aucklanders for the attack. They were moved up. I believe they were moved up. The war diary says they moved up at 12:30. I think the war... You have to be sceptical of war diaries. They're often written up days after the event. I think the whoever wrote it up got his timings wrong, because there's other evidence that the Canterburys were brought up to support the attack. Another significant reason why Malone wouldn't have been ordered to attack was that the Wellington Infantry Battalion was deployed defensively, was not in the position to attack. When Hawke's Bay Company was on Cheshire Ridge, the Ruahens and Taranakis were on the other ridge facing Battleship Hill, and the Wellington West Coast were down in the valley and back in Chilak Deer in the reserve. So Clark said they were all lined up ready to attack. Well, they certainly weren't. They were still manning their trenches. And there are many newspaper letters from Wellington soldiers that bear out the fact that the Wellington Battalion did nothing more during the day than dig trenches and man their positions. Another significant reason is that Charlie Clark was not in a position to hear Malone and Johnson, I believe, because his company was 200 metres away down in the valley. It wasn't anywhere near where Malone and Johnson were. He wasn't in a position to overhear, unless he was sent up as a runner for some reason. But you don't usually send a corporal, you would send a private as a runner, I think, if you were wanting to run up against somebody. And none of the surviving senior officers of the Wellington Battalion, Cunningham, Harston, and Cook, who was at brigade headquarters, made any mention of Wellington ever being ordered to attack at 10:45. And you believe me, if there had been a refusal of an order, that would have been a sensation, and it would have been around the brigade in no time. I believe that Clark, his memory wasn't too bad. I think he did remember an altercation on that day, but it wasn't at 10:45, it was more like 5:15. When the Wellington Battalion arrived on the road to Denton Ridge, Major Templey, the brigade major, arrived and urged Malone to keep going. The orders were to keep going. Of course, they were supposed to be on Chinook Bear by before dawn, but the delays had ensured that they came out onto Rhododendron Ridge in daylight, which is a different kettle of fish to attacking during the night. But Templey, it appears, said, "You've got to keep going, you've got to keep going." And Malone refused to keep going. And that, I think, may have been the reason that Clark, who may have been there, heard them arguing. Malone, in fact, decided to deploy his units in defensive positions, as I've already mentioned, to hold Apeg, to hold the Apeg. The Wellington Battalion history gives a clue. Major Temperley, the brigade major, arrived as companies were getting into position and was anxious for Colonel Malone to push on with the attack, as Otago and Canterbury were apparently too scattered and out of touch as a result of the night's operations to effectively carry out the assault. Colonel Malone held the view that much had been gained, and while the chance offered, it was better now that daylight had intervened, that what had been gained should be secured. The heights were within easy assaulting distance, but the troops were tired and weary and in no mood for a rapid advance in broad daylight up a steep hillside. Undoubtedly, he's correct. It would have been a disaster, even though the suggestion is there's very few Turkish troops on top of Tunic there. There were troops on Battleship Hill, and if you've been there and been on Battleship Hill and looked across towards Rhododendron Ridge, it would be just a shooting gallery if someone tried to advance up there in daylight. Malone sent a message to Brigade, "I'm occupying a position nearly at the head of gully. I'm not sure of my position. I'm lining the crest of surrounding ridges so as to ensure reasonable safety. I'm reconnoitering further and will act on further knowledge and report." And that's a sketch map that he drew of the positions that he adopted. You can see Hawke's Bay on the right. Wellington West Coast and the line, the double line is Chilak Deer, and Taranaki Company and Ruahini Company deployed round the apex. Now the Wellington Battalion timeline on the 7th of 8th August, they moved up onto Rhododendron Ridge at 5:15, as I mentioned, and then at 6 a.m. they deployed in defensive positions around the apex. Now their war diary says that at 6 p.m. elements of each companies were sent to sections of the firing line to take up positions, which I assume, because they were already in defensive positions, must have been the pinnacle of where the Aucklanders had been. Sometime after midnight, they got the order to attack Tunic Bear at dawn and advanced at 4:15 a.m., just before dawn. And of course, we all know the story of the epic stand on the top of Tunic Bear, and Malone himself was killed around 5 p.m. So that is basically my argument on both of those myths. It's very much a once over lightly. I'm happy to send, I've done a more detailed account of both, and I'm happy to send people those accounts if they want to give me their email address afterwards, if they want to delve a little bit more deeply into the details. So I will stop now.
Are there any questions related to the Freyberg myth initially and then the Malone myth secondly? You got any questions?
Of interest, are there people in the audience, have you climbed the New Zealand track in Tunic Bear? Is yes. Anybody done that?
Yeah.
So, you know, you can see how challenging that land was. If you climb Tunic Bear and see the ground that they had to cover and get up there, you can certainly appreciate that time. And it's not until you put your feet on the ground on Tunic Bear that you get appreciation for those leaders and those soldiers. So just a mini to both the stories for your...
Okay,
for
thanks,
Solomon.
Apart from the corporal's claim, is there any other evidence that Malone refused the order?
I could get into a real seminar here and discuss with you what happened on that afternoon. It's a lot more detailed than what I could possibly tell you now. There is no other evidence, no. No. And all the main characters, including Temperley, never mentioned any border. And Temperley had argued that Johnson should not make the attack. Now, if Johnson had ordered another battalion to attack, that would have been further evidence for Temperley's claim that Johnson made a mistake in attacking the ultimate battalion. So,
you're saying that this is a myth which has arisen from the basically from the interview with Lance Corporal and Clark, because you know it's got a lot of resonance with the rebellious New Zealanders against the incompetent Pox. It's where I've left.
So Johnson was a New Zealander. His father was a mayor of Wellington. To call him a British commander is also something strange. It makes more sense if he was calling Temperley a British officer. But the papers passed.
I said he was arguing with two British officers.
Two British officers. I believe that there must have been another British officer with Temperley, possibly Bentinck, Godley's man. It doesn't make sense that he would call Johnson a British officer. Anyway, as I said, papers passed is a great source, and if you look on papers passed at Wellington Battalion letters, which I've commented on, there is no evidence they were ever lined up at mid-morning to make an attack. And it's something that they would have mentioned in their letters. Why would they not mention we were about to attack and we were ordered back? No one mentioned it. So there's no actual corroboration of Charlie Clark claiming that the attack was a...
But I'm trying to agree with you, because if he got the nationality of the two people he was talking to wrong, maybe he's recollecting another incident, as you said, where he was arguing with two British officers.
Yes, and I believe that's right. And that's why Malone said, I'm commanding his men. Timberley was a major, Malone was a lieutenant colonel. If a British officer of superior rank told Malone to attack, that's a different story. You were refusing an order in the face of the enemy.
Another question over here.
It's really that I would like to think that all historians had read Old Johnston's personal letter describing Charlie Clare, which was written to his brother in law, Dan Whitfield.
Okay.
Yes, I've seen that.
Just in terms of the war diary, who writes the war diary and who actually decides what's actually recorded? Because I mean, I've seen plenty of presentations over here when you talk about war diaries and the actual units, but who actually does that recording and so who actually ultimately decides what goes into it?
Well, I guess the Lieutenant Colonel would be the final responsible officer, but he would assign someone to prepare the war diary and make okay, I'll tick it in. But I would think it would be an officer below the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. But I can't tell you specifically. Chris might be able to.
Adjutant. Usually it's the adjutant's job.
Keeps the log.
And the CO checks it. But of course, as Ian has said, they would have been written from the various signals, often on notepaper, taken at the time, in those circumstances, after the event.
And the other thing, of course, was Malone was killed before the diary would have even been written.
Yeah, well, that's another issue, isn't it? Yeah. So you can see, you know, how challenging it is, so many years later, to try and either put it all together, or, you know, to do the research, you know, to try and verify what actually occurred and why it occurred. Any other questions?
So the Wellington agitated Miss Harston, who became a judge as prominent figure after all that.
Yeah.
And there is a considerable correspondence between Harston and John North, who wrote one of the first histories, Gallipoli, The Fading Vision. And it involved Aspinall Oglander, the British official historian. And I think they're now, the Malone papers, those copies are in the Turnbull?
Yes.
Yeah. Any other questions? I'm sort of mindful of the time, but it's been a long day for some. Well, look, let's wrap it up again. Look, really appreciate you coming up, because at the end of the day, this guy was on his deathbed almost with flu, COVID and everything else mixed together, wasn't it? Poor old Chris went downhill very rapidly and, in fact, was going to give the presentation tonight on the heroes of Rossignol Wood. And hopefully we'll hear more about that maybe next year, maybe next Armistice Day. But look, would you all please join me in thanking Ian very much for coming up and standing in and also giving a most enlightening presentation.